Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, let's see. Here's where we are on a Friday. Bitcoins, beef prices, and burger chains. We'll have the week that was as well, and the end of our series, The Innovators. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on a Friday, everybody. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the last day of February 2014. Tailor-made, I would say, for a look back at the week that was. Lee Gallagher and John Carney are the lucky participants today in our weekly wrap. She is at Fortune Magazine. He is at the Wall Street Journal. And they are both in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
So, John, gross domestic product is where we will start. Came out today, revised downward to a, I'm going to say, measly 2.4%. What are you going to say?
I have to say that we knew it was going to be not a terrific number, but it, you know, was not, you know, nothing horrific. It did, not a really big downside surprise.
Lee?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fundamentally an optimist. You know, it's not 1.8%. I mean, it could have been worse. And, you know, we had a lot of headwinds toward the end of the year. Weather, everybody says, seems to be playing more of a role than initially thought. Business investment, you know, people were sitting on a lot of inventory. So that was naturally down a little bit. And there were things like cuts to unemployment benefits and even the payroll tax still. We did have some headwinds, but, you know, it doesn't mean that things won't pick up from here.
Can I ask a parenthetical question to either of you? Why do we pay so much attention to this thing when it is revised so wildly every month, John?
One big reason is because lots and lots of people throughout the government and private enterprise use this when they're planning things. It gives them a piece of information about how the economy seems to be doing. And so they try to build off it, even though it gets revised and revised. It's the best thing we have. So you use what you got.
All right. Fair enough. Lee, you want to weigh in on that one or no?
Yeah. I mean, it's the one number that sort of takes the temperature of everything at once. You know, in theory, everything is baked into this number. It's like, how we doing? This is it. And it's easy. It's like either a two or a three. It's not, you know, incremental percentages.
Look, every time you go to the doctor, they take your blood pressure. That doesn't tell you why your blood pressure is high or low, but you still pay attention to the number, and then you get to investigate what happened after that.
Or like your weight even more.
All right. Anyway, before we get too far into the medical appointment here, Janet Yellen, Madam Chair, I think is what she's decided she wants to be called, of the Fed, went to Capitol Hill this week. And she said in what was relatively brief testimony, she was only up there in front of the Senate for 2 hours. She said things have softened a little bit. Given that and the GDP number, you guys still all right with the economy?
I'm a little worried. Not just the GDP number. If you look at things like corporate bond issuance, municipal bond issuance, there's all these signs of softening. That the mortgage originations are down.
There's
a lot of frightening signs out there that say things might be slowing down a little more dramatically than we thought they were going to in the first quarter.
And Lee, even though you are an optimist, I mean, come on, this would be like the fourth year out of five that spring has not been kind to us.
Oh my God, remember those green shoots?
I know. Where is he?
I know.
And that guy, who said that? He's retired now.
he's out of there.
Look what happened to him.
Yeah, it's true. But I mean, I don't know. The Fed is still not making any changes to its plan to sort of slowly taper here.
Yep. No,
and,
that's true.
You know, I would say the one number that I worry about the most is probably actually the jobs number, because that's been really surprisingly negative the past couple months.
Which will come out next week. We did get some numbers this week, though, Lee, on housing. You literally wrote a book on housing. Numbers were kind of meh. I mean,
yeah, they were mixed.
Yeah.
They were mixed.
So
I
what
mean,
do you
existing
make of that?
Existing sales were a little bit better. New home sales, not so good. You know, the most important number, one of the most important numbers for the housing market is actually going to come in the jobs report next week. And that is the employment rate among the young people, because we have so many young people stuck at home living with their parents. And Jed Kolko from Trulio has talked a lot about this. But this is, as they start to move out, that portends potentially very well.
Right. If you can't get a job, you can't move into your own apartment.
Right. Exactly. All right. John Carney at it's a new job, The Wall Street Journal, right?
Yes, indeed.
And Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Her book, by the way, should you want to go out and buy it, it's gotten rave reviews. It's called The End of what? The Suburbs or Suburbs?
The End of the Suburbs.
The End
Thank
of the
you,
suburbs.
Kai.
There, anytime. Anytime. We'll see you guys later. Have a good weekend.
Thanks.
You too.
All right. On Wall Street today, well, a little up, a little down. Kind of nutso. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The future of money died just a little bit today. Mt. Gox, one of the biggest and oldest Bitcoin exchanges, filed for bankruptcy in Tokyo this morning. As much as $500 million could be gone in what the company says was a hacking attack. But as Dan Bobkoff reports, Bitcoin believers, that is those who have money in the game, say there are still ways for users and investors to keep their virtual money safe and maybe even profit from it.
To talk to Bitcoin proponents, the fall of Mt. Gox is a good thing, seriously. They say this is part of a natural shaking out in a new industry, clearing out bad actors so that the serious entrepreneurs can take over.
Well, I think that this is kind of now the end to amateur hour.
Jordan Kelly is the CEO of Robocoin, which bills itself as the first Bitcoin ATM. He's undeterred, actually glad for the Bitcoin publicity this week. Businesses like his are banking on a long future for Bitcoin. And he says despite Mt. Gox, there remain good, safe places to buy Bitcoins.
You want to be buying all of your coins off of, you know, trusted exchanges like Bitstamp or Vault of Satoshi.
Another believer who isn't shaken is Nick Shalick.
Yeah, I think the Mt. Gox situation is really disappointing, but it absolutely does not change my long-term view on the value of Bitcoin.
Shalick's a partner at Ribbit Capital, which invests in both Bitcoins and related companies. He says the next wave of entrepreneurs are far more serious about transparency and security.
Bitcoin is another form of money, and there are many different ways that you could keep your cash secure, for example.
Proponents like George Saman actually welcome regulation, which he thinks will give Bitcoin more legitimacy and safety. He's the COO of BTC.SX, a site for trading Bitcoin derivatives. He says placing bets on Bitcoin's future helps investors hedge.
If you think the price is going to go up, you could go long. If you think the price is going to go down, you could go short.
But he's not taking any chances. He says when he looks at his Bitcoins, he makes sure to take a photo of the computer screen with his smartphone, just in case. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
A word now about hamburgers and chuck steaks and prime rib and ground round. The word would be expensive. The price of that protein on the hoof has been rising. Beef prices were up 5% last year, still going that way in point of fact. So we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith to figure out what's going on.
Trevor Bundy is the protein manager for Fleischer's Grass-Fed and Organic Meats in New York. It's a chain of butcher shops. Bundy's wearing a chainmail apron and sharpening his knife, getting ready to butcher a beef chuck. That's the front quarter of a cow.
So I'm taking it apart into individual cuts, what we call the Atlantic City strip, chuck tender, top blade, shoulder clod, which is a ranch steak. So basically,
cuts from the front of the cow tend to be less expensive, but they're still not cheap. In fact, the cost of these steaks is more than 10% higher than it was last year, and the price of beef is expected to jump as much as 15% this year.
Retail beef prices are at or near record highs.
Ricky Volpe is a research economist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Really, the story is pretty simple, and it begins back in 2007 and 2008. In both those years, we saw basically every macroeconomic factor that influences food prices working in the same direction to start driving up food price inflation.
That would be high prices for fuel and feed, especially corn. Suddenly, the cost of raising a cow got much higher. At the same time, the economic recession had people eating less meat, so ranchers cut back their herds. Since 2011, Volpe says, fuel and feed costs have fallen, and demand for beef has jumped as the economy's improved and consumers have been more willing to spend. Time for ranchers to beef up their herds, right?
Unfortunately, they have continued to experience external shocks, mostly in the form of weather, that have set them back, that have raised their own costs and their own risks so high that they haven't taken the plunge towards expanding.
The result? The number of cows in the hamburger-hungry U.S. is now way too low to meet demand, says Don Close, a cattle economist with Rabo AgriFinance.
It's been pretty dramatic. Total cattle is the lowest we've had since 1951, and our cows and heifers inventory is the smallest inventory since 1941. So without a question, we're working with substantially tighter supplies.
And increasing supplies isn't easy, says Close. Cows carry their calves for 9 months, and steer aren't usually slaughtered for beef until they're 2 years old. So we probably won't see a substantial increase in beef supplies for another few years, and prices are likely to stay high.
This is just our walk-in where we store all the meat.
In Fleischer's warehouse in Brooklyn, manager Bill Kavanaugh shows off shelves of aging steaks.
The oldest ones up there are about 3 weeks. Those are about ready to go.
We're looking at about $17,000 worth of steak. Kavanaugh says Americans want to buy more beef, but the best cuts like these have gotten so expensive, it's pushing customers to look for alternatives.
Customers, they're looking for something maybe as delicious and they can feed their family on, but maybe isn't as expensive as, you know, the giant steak they would have bought maybe even just a couple years ago.
Kavanaugh says his stores are stocking more ground beef, sausages, and other cheaper options. Butcher Trevor Bundy says he's seeing customers getting more creative and trying cheaper cuts.
So this is the chuck. You know, personally, this is my absolute favorite. Last meal would be chuck, I promise. Yeah, just, to me, that's just as beefy as it gets. It's like all the flavor right there. It's a humble but ultimately very delicious and pretty affordable. So, you know.
A lot of people are ditching red meat altogether. Demand for chicken has taken flight in the last year. And now poultry prices are rising, too. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, the man who first put black stories on the silver screen.
And that was a pretty remarkable and sort of revolutionary approach during that time period.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 49 points today, a third of 1%, closed at 16,321. The NASDAQ down 10 points, a quarter percent, ended things at 4,308. The S&P 500 up 5 points, a quarter percent, closing at yet another record high, 1,859. For the week, the Dow up 1.4%, the NASDAQ up 1.1%, the S&P 500 picked up 1.33%. Online travel firm TripAdvisor skipped up 0.5% today when analysts upgraded the stock from negative to neutral. Salesforce.com weakened almost 6%. Its profit forecast announced yesterday was largely below expectations. Menswear chain Joseph A. Bank donned about 3% yesterday. It rejected a takeover bid from rival Clothier Men's Warehouse, saying it didn't meet the interests of its investors. Men's Warehouse put on 6.67%. That one keeps going back and forth, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for January. Twitterless, still using the telephone to communicate. Let's thank inventor Alexander Graham Bell, born on March 3rd, 1847. And it's International Ideas Month. Think, people. Then write it down. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is news today from the world of fast food. Quiznos, the chain perhaps best known for its toasted subs, which tasty as they may not be enough. Quiznos is said to be getting ready to file for bankruptcy protection. That's in the Wall Street Journal this morning. Seems part of the problem is franchisees who are unhappy with how much money it takes to run a Quiznos. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports the cost of selling fast food depends a lot on which chain you are trying to join.
So you want your own slice of McHeaven? A McDonald's franchise will cost you.
Total investment between $1.1 to $2.1 million, depending on the layout and size of that McDonald's.
Don Snigowski edits Blue Mau Mau, a new site for franchise owners. He says those millions of dollars include the cost of building your McDonald's, plus you have to pay about 16% of your sales to Mickey D's for royalties and advertising. Does that sound a little steep? Try Subway.
Well, I left home about 6 and opened the store at 7 o'clock.
That's Keith Miller. He owns 3 Subway stores in the Sacramento, California area and still works the early shift. Miller says to start a Subway, you'd need at least $200,000, and royalties and ad fees only eat up about 12% of your sales. Miller says make sure you're not required to buy too much equipment from your parent company, the franchisor. Otherwise,
all of a sudden, a $5,000 refrigerator becomes $6,000 because the franchisor is collecting $1,000 off of that.
Miller says franchising has gotten a lot more expensive since he opened his first Subway in 1989. That's partly because fast food chains are facing more competition from fast casual chains. According to Sam Okus, the editor of a trade publication called QSR Magazine.
So I think some of these bigger quick service companies are really fortifying their franchisee base to make sure they can compete with these upstart fast casual brands.
So the fast food folks want the strongest, richest franchisees they can get. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
On a very tense day in the region, the deposed president of Ukraine popped up in southern Russia. Today, Viktor Yanukovych held a press conference in which he vowed to make a comeback. Ukrainian authorities would like nothing better, although it won't be a warm welcome for him. They want to put Yanukovych on trial for the deaths of about 100 people in the violence last week in Kiev. Late this afternoon in Washington, by the way, President Obama warned Russia to watch its step in Ukraine, although not in so many words from the president, obviously. In London, meanwhile, some of Yanukovych's former financiers, extremely wealthy Ukrainian oligarchs, are feeling the heat themselves. From the British capital, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
When you've bought an apartment at No. 1 Hyde Park and you forked out $225 million for it, the highest price ever for a London pad, you don't expect to get this on your doorstep.
Sanctions for oligarchs! Sanctions for oligarchs! Sanctions for oligarchs!
Scores of protesters waving placards and shouting sanctions for the oligarchs. Ukrainian activists here have made this exclusive London apartment block a regular target.
Because One Hyde Park is an icon of corruption in Ukraine.
Sergei Burns, a Ukrainian who lives in London, says the fact that Ukraine's richest man, Rinat Akhmetov, owns an apartment here is an outrage.
This is the example of how the poorest country in Europe can have the richest oligarch who buys the most expensive and luxury flat in London.
Akhmetov built his $15 billion fortune out of the scramble for state-owned assets in the 1990s. He's been accused of using his money to finance the now ousted Ukrainian president. Stefan Shakhno, another activist, says Akhmetov must bear some of the blame for the protesters killed last week in Kiev and must be made to pay.
We want to put pressure on him and let him know that he cannot hide here, and this bloody money that he has stolen from the Ukrainian people should be returned back to Ukraine.
Akhmetov isn't the only Ukrainian oligarch with a foothold in London now attracting protest. This demonstration was outside the London Stock Exchange. Protesters complained that the exchange had allowed another oligarch, Dmitry Firtash, to formally open the trading. Firtash is also accused of plundering Ukraine and financing repression. British-born Ukrainian Kristina Chimera is angry with the Brits for rolling out the red carpet for the oligarchs.
It makes my blood boil that whilst people are dying on the streets of Kiev, they're allowed to live in London, live luxury lives with the most expensive flats. I think it's time for government institutions to ask whether they've got Ukrainian blood on their hands.
The activists want the British government to withdraw the oligarchs' visas. That seems unlikely to happen. The UK bends over backwards to attract rich foreigners. Over the past 5 years, 850 Russian oligarchs and Chinese multimillionaires have been given the right to live in Britain. And as Nick Redman of the International Institute for Strategic Studies points out, inquiring into whether the oligarchs' wealth is ill-gotten or not wouldn't be easy.
Taking a judgment about what was legitimate and what was not legitimate 20 years ago in a situation of considerable turbulence and uncertainty is a difficult one.
And he argues the oligarchs are not that different from America's robber barons.
If you look back into some of the big fortunes of US capitalists of the 19th century, those people then went on to endow museums and other things. And in a way, that's what people like Mr. Akhmetov and Mr. Firtash are doing now.
The oligarchs have been recasting themselves as philanthropists. Late last year, Firtash paid for this free festival of Ukrainian music, art, literature and food in London. But after the bloodshed in Kiev, laundering the image of the oligarchs may be impossible. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
All this week, we've been focusing on innovators, men and women who've ignored the status quo and in doing so changed the way business gets done. African-American innovators, to be specific. Today, the movie industry and a filmmaker named Oscar Michaud. He made more than 44 movies back in the early part of the last century about the black experience at that time. Dr. Rhea Combs is museum curator at the National Museum of African-American History and Culture in Washington. Dr. Combs, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
We go way back to start talking about Oscar Michaud, don't we? We're talking 1915 or so when he starts getting into movies.
This is true, yes.
What was it like back then for an African-American man trying to get into what was, first of all, a growing, booming industry, but also a very white industry?
The challenges were manifold. We're talking about an American history where we had African-American men being lynched in tremendous numbers. We also had the growth of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm. We had individuals, African-Americans, still trying to sort of find their way, if you will, in a socioeconomically segregated country. And so it was in that sort of vein that he was able to remarkably make lemonade out of the lemons.
Well, he was making films about I guess you'd call it the African-American lifestyle and what it was like back then, right?
Absolutely. I mean, what he was doing was what has been called race films, which was primarily him being able to create films that really showed African-Americans on screen, that allowed a unique opportunity, if you will, for African-American images to be projected and to be showcased and looking at African-American life. And that was a pretty remarkable and sort of revolutionary approach during that time period.
And not to be really base about it, but he was creating jobs for African-American actors and actresses, and I imagine crews and lighting technicians and cameramen and the whole deal.
All of that in the midst of the fact that he had no experience doing it. So, yes, he was creating opportunities. He had a sort of what they call a black star system, similar to the Hollywood star system that was predominant in the early part of the 20th century. He was doing that within the African-American community. He often used the same actors and actresses within his films. With his creative financing and with his sort of shrewd business acumen, he was able to really kind of bundle, if you will, his actors and actresses and package them in such a way that it helped with his productivity. It was quite efficient in that regard.
Where did he get the money to do this? I can't imagine he had ready access to capital.
If we think about Oscar Michaud, he just had this tremendous entrepreneurial mind. And prior to becoming a filmmaker, he was a Pullman porter. And it was through those relationships that he had made across the country that he was able to finance his films.
How was he and his work, they received in the white world of the time?
Well, mixed reviews.
Yeah, or didn't it matter, I guess?
Well, that's what I was going to state, that he was really kind of playing both sides of the fence, if you will. I think that white world helped finance the films, and it was the black world who embraced the images of themselves being seen on screen.
One thing you don't, as you read about Oscar Michaud and do research to talk to somebody about Oscar Michaud, one thing that does not come out is any comments on the quality of his filmmaking. He was not necessarily a great filmmaker as an art form.
Scholars argue that it was a bit uneven. Yes, indeed.
A bit uneven, says the scholar.
But again, keeping in mind that a lot of that was based on the fact that he was really about sort of churning out these images. And if it worked, cool. If it didn't, then, yeah. Let's move on to the next. I mean, he at one point was striving to do 4 films a year. That's pretty incredible.
He was quite literally present at the birth of Hollywood and the film industry in this country.
Yes. Yes, he was.
And shaped it, I imagine. Yeah.
Indeed.
Can we still say that?
I would say, you have people like Paul Robeson, who were part of his cast, who went on and made a sort of tremendous impression within American culture. Oscar Micheaux was definitely there fighting to kind of promote and further African-Americans within the Hollywood system.
Rhea Combs is a museum curator at the National Museum of African-American History and Culture. It is a part of the Smithsonian Institution. Dr. Combs, thanks very much for your time.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You can check out all the stories from this week's series, The Innovators, we call it. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that it's raining in Los Angeles and much of California today. So, of course, the traffic here in L.A. has been horrendous. 77 accidents, the Los Angeles Times says, just in the morning commute alone. And it's entirely possible it's going to get worse for reasons not weather related. A state court here has ruled that it's okay, completely legal, to check maps on your phone while you're driving. You can't talk unless it's hands-free, and you can't text at all, but you can check your maps. What could possibly go wrong? Oh, I have no idea. I do know, however, that that's Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Orr. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.